Вие сте со SPS на Македонски. Слушнете повеќе прилози на sps.com.au/Macedonian.
Captain Mile Glumčevski, welcome to SBS Macedonian.
Thank you very much for having me.
I've got to say we're thrilled to be having this chat with you as a knighted member of the Australian Armed Forces who is part Macedonian. So congratulations.
Thank you very much. It is a very lovely honour. I have nothing left to say except I'm quite honoured to receive it.
Well, the knighthood bestowed upon you by the King of Cambodia, Norodom Sihamoni, was for distinguished services to the King and the people of Cambodia over a period of 25 years or so, voluntary assistance in the field of mental health. Tell us how you came to be connected to the nation some 30 years ago.
Yeah, it was some 30 years ago. Being a little bit younger, i.e. almost 30 years, I was at Monash University. And I had really loose plans around going to Cambodia, and there happened to be a dinner. I'd finished my bachelor, and I had two majors, so pharmacology and systems physiology and central nervous system. So I was very much interested in drugs and behavior, brains and behavior. And I went to this dinner, and I sat beside this lovely gentleman, and now His Excellency Dr. Imcoit, and we happened to sit side by side, and we're talking about the psychology department, which was about to start in Cambodia, which I was very excited about because I was very much into that field, and had a chat for a little while. And after about 2 or 3 minutes, as you do when you're that age, you're quite impertinent. And I turned around and said, excuse me, doctor, I don't mean to be rude, but your PhD is obviously not in neuropsychology. And he went, that is absolutely correct. He says, mine is in educational statistics. And I said to him, well, why are you teaching neuropsychology? He said, there's no one in the country who can. Would you like the job?
Just like that.
Well, yeah, it was pretty much like that. So I finished my glass of wine. I looked him square in the eyes and went, okay. I said, but I got one question. How much does it pay? And he went, $17 US a month. And I went, all right, I'm in. almost three decades later. So that's pretty much how I got the job.
So you're still working there?
Yes.
That's incredible.
Probably indicative. I mean, after all these years, I have been promoted once. I've gone from assistant lecturer to lecturer. So one promotion in that time.
Were there any initial obstacles? For instance, language, culture?
Everything you can imagine.
Tell us a bit about that.
Well, one of the reasons I went to Cambodia, was Cambodia had the poorest functioning university in the world. So there were three countries at that stage poorer than Cambodia, but Cambodia had the only functioning university. So I'm not sure if you know much about the history of Cambodia, but basically the genocide, they executed about 30% of the population. It was all the doctors, teachers, lawyers, etc. Anyone who'd been to university was executed in a very short period. So massive deficits in the country. So when I started at the university, there was little things that they didn't have, like water, electricity, doors, windows, just small things were missing. Now throw that from a young Australian Macedonian boy, you know, from Monash University in Melbourne. It's a little bit different to what I was used to.
Yes.
I arrived in Cambodia, I could say, you know, things like, hello, my name is, where is the bathroom? And I had some very formal language for asking for food and things, but that was about it, about 4 or 5 sentences. Unfortunately, to be honest, about the same level as my Macedonian. So I'll get that embarrassment up front first.
But you have improved, haven't you, since then?
My Cambodian has improved, yes, immensely. I now teach on the master's program and, you know, obviously not having a translator and teaching sort of in-depth psychological information, I'll put my hand up and say that my Macedonian still hasn't progressed. Sakash Cafe.
So what about the students? Did they have any knowledge of English at all?
No. At the time, I was paired with Dr. Imcoit. We did a lot of translation. There was a lot of hand gesturing, a lot of pictures, a lot of, you know, a reverse translation. The first couple of months, within about 6 months, my Cambodian was reasonable enough to, you know, carry out lectures and get my message across and explain things.
So it would have been a fairly difficult journey.
Look, I think looking back, maybe I could say that. I mean, I think when you're living a life, it's not. It's like any other lifestyle. You just adapt and books were such an issue in those days, and getting the students to buy books or even photocopy books and things. So that was hard. So because we basically had no kind of doors or windows or anything, what we did is I basically drew a biopsychology book around the room. And as we did lectures, I would add more pictures and more words of, you know, how the central nervous system worked, how the peripheral, the autonomic nervous system, et cetera. And so we used those types of methods. That was the initial days of teaching, because even the blackboard, I remember it being broken into about four or five pieces, and it was pretty hard to write on the blackboard.
Yes.
So obstacles, yes. Confirm, obviously, there's the language, there's the culture. Myself coming from Melbourne, being a very, you know, independent culture. I'd left home when I was 16, moving to a very collective culture where, you know, if I would ask a question, I didn't understand the first couple of weeks why nobody would put their hand up or answer any of my questions.
Right.
And luckily, one of my colleagues tapped me on the shoulder one day and he says, you're wasting your time there. And I went, why? He says, well, for the last 30 years, if they put their hand up, they get shot in the back of the head. Oh, he said, nobody's putting their hand up to answer your questions. And I went, really good point. Never considered that.
So how did you get around that?
We worked. And as I build up relations, like you do, you build up relationships with people and you're able to communicate and you get an understanding of the culture.
And building trust, I guess. Too.
Yeah, it took time. It took a couple of years for me to be accepted as just one of the lecturers. It took time for the students to understand I did things slightly different because I was from a different culture and vice versa.
Yes.
Now, in saying that, I cannot be more pleased to say that some of my early students from sort of one of my students from 1994, who was my first and second year undergraduate student,
yes,
is now head of the psychology department. One of my undergraduate students from 1995-1996 is now head of department for the social work faculty. Lovely. You know, so I'm hoping that I did something right or contributed to something being done right. So, yes.
Well, it must be based on all the foundations you've laid before that.
Well, not just me. I mean, obviously, there's a whole lot of people. And, you know, I showed them one style of teaching and I showed them, you know, one set of information for a subject and how, you know, and one style of thinking about things. And, you know, they had 20 other lecturers who provided the same thing.
Well, you're right. In an article by Seaman Kylie Jagiello, you say although the award is for an individual, the achievement could not have been fulfilled had it not been for the contribution of others as well.
Yeah. I mean, I don't think you do anything by yourself in the world. You know, you look at the upbringing that you have from your parents, and then you know the educators that you have, and then you're working in a team. You know, at the time there was 14 lecturers in the psychology department when I started, when we all started together.
Yes.
You know, on top of that, you know, going through history, you know, my family, my partner and my daughter have made lots of concessions for me, basically denying us of any savings because it's spent in, you know, me travelling overseas and doing lecturing and away for, you know, weeks and sometimes months at a time, and then being very supportive, you know, your friends, your family, obviously my workplaces. These things are not done independently. Awards are given independently and are very nice. I know most people are not silly enough to think this is an independent award. It is about this massive group effort over a really sustained long period. Yeah, which is lovely.
Yes, an enormous sacrifice too on the part of many people, as you say. At what stage did you decide to enter the Australian Armed Forces, the reservists? What drew you there?
Well, I come from a military background. I have a quite lovely, I have all the way back to my great-grandfather in uniform. I think standing on some of the hills over Bithola. Actually, most of those photos are taken. So we come from Bithola, or from Bukova, the town above Bithola.
Right.
So military family, as I think many people do, and I always wanted to serve. And living in quite a few war zones, so not only Cambodia, I've lived in East Timor, Turkey, France, UK, et cetera, a number of very interesting places in the world. So when I came back to Australia and we settled and my daughter started going to school and all of that was kind of settled, I thought it was time to join the armed forces. Again, I maintain a role in the armed forces over the last, I think it's 11 years now I've been in the armed forces.
So you're an operations officer for the 2nd Force Support Battalion's 6th Logistics Support Company. That's quite a tongue twister.
That's a very new role. So your role changes a bit over time. And so my training is definitely as a logistics officer, but I've also been kind of dismounted infantry minor tactics for quite a few years now as well. So I'm quite lucky to get a very large range of exposure in the military around tactics, weapons. We spent almost all of this year in humanitarian assistance, obviously with bushfires and now COVID assist. So I'm on my third deployment this year already. So one overseas and two domestically. So the Australian Army has been very busy of recent times.
Yes, certainly you have.
I think there's a lot of people that fall into that category.
Yes, yes, yes. Well, considering all of the other work that you do, and we're getting to all of that, you're also Victorian and Western Australian General Manager for OnPsych. Can you tell us a bit about OnPsych?
Yeah, look, lovely organisation. The National Director rang me up a couple of years ago, and I was sort of looking for a job, sort of not, you know, we're in that very interesting space, and he rang me up and he said, I've had a look at your CV, and he said, you're either full of crap or you're really good. Let's have a chat. I went, oh, okay. Brilliant. The interview, the three occasions that the interview lasted sort of three separate sessions. The interview probably went for about 8 hours.
Over those three sessions.
Yeah, so right. By the time we'd actually agreed to work with each other, we had a really good knowledge of each other and what we did and our philosophies and everything. So OnPsych is a lovely organisation. It's one of the largest providers of mental health services in schools in the country. Mm. It has a really, what you think is a very simple philosophy, but really important. So the idea is that we're school-based. So we work in schools, we're family-inclusive and school-community-inclusive, and where possible, we try for no out-of-pocket costs, which is almost everybody we see. I think, you know, 99.95% of clients wouldn't pay any money out of their pocket. We don't want finances to be a barrier to mental health. And interesting enough, the founder and national director, Mr. Martin Greig, you know, he's really big at looking and supporting people. Wonderful ideas, wonderful philosophies, wonderful ways of really providing to kids that would definitely not get a service otherwise. So again, a real joy to go to work. I work with a whole bunch of psychologists, social workers, counsellors, welfare people and chaplains. And, you know, probably on any given day, we probably make a little bit of a difference and see about 1,000 kids a day. So, which is really lovely to be part of.
Yes. Now, you haven't just worked in Australia in the area of mental health. You've also worked in Malaysia, in Turkey, Cambodia, Nauru and East Timor. Now, is that part of OnPsych?
Not part of OnPsych. No, I've just joined OnPsych the last couple of years. I think just over 2 years I've been with OnPsych. I've actually been really lucky. I think I've worked for everybody. I've worked for World Health Organization. I've worked for World Vision. I've worked for tiny little NGOs. I've worked for a couple of little schools. I've worked for a number of the large hospitals in Melbourne and overseas. So, yeah, my career, I've just been very lucky. People have been good to me.
Well, Miller, what do you think all of this experience has given you?
Because it is extensive. At a professional level,
Well, I guess, professional and personal.
There's probably a bit of symbiosis there. Professionally, it's quite amazing. So that ability to work with people, no matter around culture, no matter around language, backgrounds, etc. So that ability to adapt and work with people, the ability to set really clear boundaries, but, you know, provide the best quality service that you can. That's really important. Mental health is so key to what we do, and it's so important to be aware of what's happening for our mental health and why. And a lot of people don't get the right service. A lot of people, because of their background culturally, and by culture I don't mean necessarily geographically where they came from, but, you know, a 45-year-old homeless man who has a history of heroin habits, who lives in, you know, the back streets of St Kilda in Melbourne,
yes,
has come from a very different culture from me, and probably from yourself, and probably from a lot of people. So understanding that that's a different culture with a different language, with a different understanding, allows you to work together and connect with another human being. It's been really good. I've learned so many times how little I actually know, whether it be, you know, in Turkey trying to deal with soldiers and kids in schools, or whether it be in Malaysia, you know, training in their national hospitals and, you know, arguing with nurses, whether it be being told off by the head of the Royal Melbourne Hospital Emergency Department because I've just given one of his doctors a serving for being incompetent, and then he's told me to mind my own business and then turned around and finished yelling at the doctor for me. those sorts of things. I've learnt to adapt. I've learnt that I know what I know and I'm relatively comfortable with it, but there's so much that I don't know that when I meet somebody else, they have so much else to offer around supporting and growing their own mental health, and I often trust in that.
Well, throughout your extensive global experience in the area of mental health, have you ever had to tailor your services to each of the countries you've worked in for cultural, religious or political reasons in order to be able to assist or train?
Oh, definitely, yes. Probably a really good example. So I think my first year in Malaysia was 1997, and I struggled immensely. What I struggled with is that they thought they were an Asian country, and I didn't. I just spent 4 years in a third world Asian country and going to Malaysia, which was very developed, multicultural, you know, well educated. Mm-hmm. So I struggled to see them as Asian. And people would come up to me and they would say, you know, certain things, whether it be at work or on the street. And, you know, they would say things like, blah, 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 and I'm Buddhist. And I'd say to them, oh, what does that mean to you? Or they'd say, I'm Christian. I'd say, what does that mean to you? Or I'm Muslim. I'd say, what does that mean to you? And they'd go, blah, blah, blah. And I go, well, you're an absolute idiot, because that is not the premises of that, you know. But it was a cultural identity that had more than a religious identity. And it was my misunderstanding that created those tensions and those stresses. And being, I think, younger and being probably less mature, I'd be reluctant to say I'm more mature now, but less mature then, that I couldn't understand some of the vocabulary they were using to describe their circumstances, and I took it literally as what they were saying, right, which was incorrect. So a lot of learning, a lot of complexity when you're young, and you're trying to, I think the standards of what I'm trying to deliver haven't changed. My understanding of how to deliver them have changed, if that makes sense.
Have you gained any insights on a global level, let's say, that you feel could be applied in the Australian context?
The one thing that I have learned is that lack of a plan always concerns me. When you're treating someone, you know, obviously at university, you will have a very systematic plan where you're going to start first year and you're going to do all of this, which will then be foundation to learn second year, right. Third year, and then hopefully going to master's. Treatment plans for clients. And what I've worked hard all my life and everywhere I've worked is the client needs a treatment plan. Because if you don't have a treatment plan, if you don't have some way of progressing with this client, it's not treatment. It's you and them having a nice chat and then nothing happens. So I've learnt the value of planning, of being organised. And if you're not, then you can't benefit the clients. And most of the clients you deal with, it's probably worth going back to, I spent my first 20 years as a clinician, just seeing people that were basically rape, torture, attempted murder and genocide. That's all I've seen for 20 years. If you're not going to do best by them, and that's the client group that you're dealing with, then you need to get another job. You need to stop being a mental health professional and go do something else, because these are the very vulnerable group that need that support.
Absolutely. Mila, what would you like to see on a national level in terms of how mental health services are provided in Australia?
I'd love to see a coordinated approach. You know, it's a hodgepodge at the moment. You know, the services are random. They're not connected. Nobody knows where the services are, what to do. And so, again, going back to that plan, there is no plan. We spend somewhere, I think it's increased recently, but, you know, most of the figures state that we sort of spend 7 to 8% of the health budget on mental health, and it costs somewhere between 19 and 23%. Now, I'm not a brilliant mathematician, but I think there's a kind of discrepancy there, which then means that there is no time to plan because you've got no resources to plan, which means you can't deliver a good service, which means that, you know, we've got 10 people a day killing themselves and we don't even talk about it. You know, we've lost 10 times the number of veterans returning from Afghanistan that were killed in Afghanistan. You know, every major state ambulance service in the country attend 50 significant major suicide attempts a day. So there's some pretty serious stuff going on there, which we just kind of ignore because there's no coordinated effort. And I'm not saying there's not lots of people trying, and state governments and federal governments are not trying, but there's no coordination. That's the big thing, and I'd really like to see change. I'm of the opinion, it's my training and what I've seen a thousand times, but mental health is treatable. It's no different to a broken leg. You have a disease or a situation, and of course, you know, if you break your leg and you don't exercise and your leg becomes stiff, then you can't walk very well, you can't exercise very well. If you're lazy and feeling down, then you're eating more, and so it creates all these other problems. Same with mental health, the cascade of problems. But again, broken legs, if they're not treated, they tend to not get better by themselves. The same with depression, the same with anxiety, the same with a range of mental health conditions. Proper treatment means a better recovery. Yeah, again, I'm lucky to work for another wonderful organisation, and I'm actually a volunteer with St John. In Victoria, different states, St John has different presence. In Victoria, it's a volunteer ambulance service, so we go out to lots of community events and provide a first aid presence. I am lucky enough to work with a whole lot of really wonderful people who give up one evening a week to develop their training and become very competent first aid providers. And I'm lucky enough that the organisation allowed me to assist in that. Once they've volunteered one evening to upskill themselves with a first aid qualification, they then go out to community events. Generally, most about once a month, they'll give up a day and they'll go out to some community event, whether it be a football or a concert or the local athletics or whatever, and they will make sure that they're there to make sure people are fit, safe and healthy. So John has also been absolutely lovely to me that they've assisted me in developing an international project. So part of some of my work in Cambodia is that we run first aid courses. That's now extended out to some other volunteers who are now going with me, and the plan is once or twice a year to go to Cambodia. We've set up a mobile CPR laboratory, and we have 7 dummies there. We keep a whole bunch of first aid equipment. Our last trip across, which was last year now, unfortunately, because this year's been very different, we took, I think it was 250 first aid kits, to which all the volunteers that went across, they actually left all their personal possessions pretty much in Melbourne, came across with a T-shirt and a pair of shorts and all the first aid kits in their luggage, and we distributed those. So, again, I can't emphasise, you know, that. And St John have been really lovely, and if you Google, you'll see me doing an interview and all that sort of stuff. And, you know, St John are, you know, constantly praising me, but it's such a big organisational approach. They provided the first aid kits. They provided the accreditation, you know, the process for teaching. They provided the dummy. So without sort of that sort of support,
yes,
you know, it's easy to take credit for something you do and ignore all those people that are there to support you. But that's a really good example of me of something that would never have happened unless a whole lot of people really decided, well, I'm not going to be the poster boy, but I'm going to support this activity.
Well, whether in groups or on your own, you've certainly done a lot of volunteering throughout the past few decades. What makes you keep wanting to offer your expertise in several areas for free?
I don't even ever think of it for free. I think of it as I want to say civic duty, but that probably makes it sound like there's, you know, I've had conversations many times. I don't feel there's anything altruistic in me. Like I'm not doing something for the sake of doing it. I get a lot from what I do. I think being able to benefit other people is a really important thing, and being able to connect with other people. Simple things around, if I look after someone else, they'll look after me. Simple things like if you take care of someone's basic biological needs and their first aid, take care of some of their basic psychological needs, that the community that you live in becomes a lot better, much quicker. So I almost want to say it's a little bit of a selfish desire. I want to live in a nice community, so that's not going to happen unless I do something about it. And I think there's a lot of disadvantaged people that are treated quite poorly, and it's not acceptable. So I can either ignore it or do something about it. And I figured do something about it is probably a bit easier for me.
Miller, have you published works on mental health at all?
Only about 20, 25 papers. Yeah, so I publish about once a year. I publish on a range of topics, everything from individual support plans for children with disabilities all the way through to, I'm one of the leading publishers on cardiology in Southeast Asia. But it's all around cerebrovascular accident, around post-stroke, and all the mental health implications of that. So, yes, I like to publish. Sometimes I have something valuable to say, other times maybe not so. But that little bit of that academic kind of streak in me wants to publish, at least on a semi-regular basis.
And how do you stay abreast of new developments in all of these areas that you work in?
It's very hard. It's very, very hard. What I would say to the listeners, and I'm going to be that typical Macedonian boy now, sort of say, you know, your parents, You know, I don't know about you, but growing up, my parents said, you have to be something, you know, you got to choose, you got to be a doctor or a lawyer or, you know, or something. And my parents, like any other parents, you know, want the best for you. I would say, don't listen to them. You can be what you want to be. You can be four or five things that you want to be. I've managed to qualify in four or five areas in my life and maintain those qualifications generally. I think it's just about choosing what you want to do in life. You know, with everything takes, there's effort. Effort and reward are two things that are linked. So I would say do what you want, and you really need to have a good time management schedule if you want to stay qualified in a couple of areas.
Well, you're in logistics, so it's no mystery. Yeah, you've found a way how to divide your time between Cambodia and Australia. So, but tell us about that anyway, what that involves.
So, look, my life is pretty simple. I spend about 10 days generally. Let's ignore the COVID scenario at the moment, but generally about 10 days in Melbourne. I fly in and I keep up my clinical hours by doing a couple of triage shifts, providing basically mental health assessments at the hospital in the emergency department as a triage clinician. And then I do army as well as do all my sort of on-site interviews and meet the team and schools and things, do the army requirements. And quite often, you know, I'll run a weekend or run an activity. So I do that for about 10 days and then I fly to Cambodia and I usually lecture two weekends and sort of keep that going because we schedule, you know, who's teaching what. I usually co-lecture with one or two other people, as quite normal at university. And my partner is a teacher in Vietnam. So then I go home, in effect, and relax in Vietnam for a couple of days with my lovely partner. Why she tolerates me, God knows. And then I do it all again. And that's generally my lifestyle. During the COVID-19 restrictions, myself and my team, the army, we've been posted. So we live at one army base and we work from another army base. But in effect, what we do is we supply all of the military that's deployed in Victoria with pretty much whatever they need. So very much that logistics supply. So my soldiers every day get in and they go to every part of Melbourne and Victoria dropping off the equipment that's required. So whether that's for the door knocking, whether that's for masks, whether that's for water, etc. And then also we kind of a little bit of a reserve element that like a week or two ago they were short 30 people. So we jumped straight in and we were doing the actual door knocking for people that had COVID or close contact. So quite busy, but it's nice to work with a, you know, great group of soldiers who are, you know, positive and just, you know, just want to do their bit to make sure people are safe.
You mentioned positive.
Sorry, the people that we were door knocking for, yes, they were positive COVID. So my soldiers are more than prepared to put their own risk aside, so their own safety aside to ensure the safety of the community. So big effort for them. Really, really good. It's good to work with people who have that community spirit.
Well done. Well, Milik Lamtivsky, you're incredible. You've given us a good bit of advice. You're an inspiration to us all and a credit to your Macedonian and Australian family. Thank you for speaking with SBS Macedonian. And hopefully the next discussion will be in Macedonian.
Look, my father will probably listen to this interview now you've done. I'm going to get phone calls and, you know, just go, okay, you have to learn. How many years have you been telling me? Yes, my father's very, very proud Macedonian, who happens to also be Milik Lamtivsky. We come from a lovely village. The last time I was there was about 18 months ago with my uncle. I could not be prouder of my Macedonian heritage, and I will take advantage to talk the ear off anyone who will listen about it. So thank you very much for having me.
Thank you very much. And Bukovo, by the way, is also famous for its chilies, isn't it?
Yes, I believe so. Yes, I think it's famous for colours, but chilies definitely, yes.
By the way, could you tell us just before we go, how many languages do you speak?
Not Macedonian.
That's one.
My English is quite reasonable on most days. I speak Khmer. My Malaysian and Indonesian are quite okay. I did do one of my masters in Malaysia and I did spend quite a bit of time working in East Timor. So I can get by quite comfortably conducting psychological interviews in those languages.
Well, Milik Lamtivsky, once again, ti blagodaram za razgovor od denesin.
Thank you very much, and thank you very much for taking the time out to talk with me. I really appreciate it.
You're very welcome. Thank you.
Have a great day.
Сакате ли да чуете повеќе прилози како овој? Слушате подкаст преку Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify или од каде и да ги добивате вашите подкасти.